Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire's known as the Granite State, but it could also claim to be the land of the library. The first state library in America was founded here, as was the first local public library in Peterborough, New Hampshire in 1833. But how much does that illustrious history help libraries survive and thrive today? At a time when many people do their research and reading online, what's the purpose of these bricks and mortar institutions? This hour on The Exchange, libraries look to the future. And let's hear from you. What do you want from your local library? How often do you even go there? How good a job does it do serving your community? Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We had three guests for the hour. Michael York is here, New Hampshire's state librarian, overseeing the state library in Concord, and also assisting the state's 234 local public libraries. And Michael, it's always nice to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to see you.
Also with us, Amy Lappin, Deputy Director of the Lebanon Public Libraries, and there are two. She's also New Hampshire's representative to the American Library Association. And Amy, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And also with us, Jeffrey Hoover. He's Library Design Director with Tappe Architects, which advises and designs libraries on updating their facilities with the wants of today's patrons in mind. And Jeffrey, good to see you. Welcome back.
It's good to be back.
Well, and Michael, I want to start with you with this basic question. Why bother going to the library when I can research everything online, download ebooks, stream movies or TV shows? Why do I need the library?
Well, libraries always adjust, always have adjusted to the new changing technologies, to the needs of newer generations. America is constantly changing, and libraries are there to change with it. So although there is lots of material on in digital format that's available to people in their homes, libraries are providing those resources as well.
Online, you can
online.
Get
you can
books
go, you
and
can,
so forth.
Indeed. You can go online to Amazon and pay $16 for a book if that's your want. But you can also go to the downloadable book consortium that's run by our 205 libraries in the state of New Hampshire and do the same thing free of charge. Libraries are there for everyone, those who can afford materials and those who can't afford those materials.
How would you answer that question, Amy?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, libraries are there for everyone, and there's this assumption that we all have a cell phone in our pocket and can do massive research with that cell phone. I mean, Google will get us so far, but you know, we provide databases that quite frankly cost the libraries a lot of money. So when you're at home doing that research, that comes from our library budgets. I mean, we're needed more than ever. We also have there's a real economic divide. Not everybody has that technology in their home, and we have it for them. We have training for that. We can help people use those resources. Quite frankly, I mean, we're busier than ever. We really are. We have meeting rooms. We're a community space. Some libraries have gardens in the back. And our books still go out. I mean, quite frankly, our books are still circulating at a fast pace. So the library is not dead.
You know, some people might be surprised to hear you say that, Amy, that you're busier than ever, because it does seem like people are just reading on their Kindles. And I mean, I know my kids, when they do research for their papers, they do not go to the library and pull out books off the shelves.
Yeah. Well, the books are still there, but they also may be missing some resources that are there. And so, you know, when you go into the library, it used to be you'd go into the library and there was Time magazine from 1957 and I could pull that up and do some real hard research, you know, and that's all still there, but it's there electronically, right? And it's not something you can just Google and get those resources. You really do need to be into some of these databases or to get better information.
Well, that's the thing too, is you think you can get everything on Google, but when you get a search result, you don't know what you're not getting. So you're saying go to the library and find out.
That's exactly right. And we have people who come in because they don't have a computer at home. You know, not everybody is hooked up to the internet at home.
Well, and it's expensive.
It's expensive. Yeah.
You want to jump in, Michael, and then Jeffrey,
well,
I want to hear from you.
I would mention,
why bother?
That the person who's most often thought of as making everything widely available to people is Bill Gates. And Bill Gates saw that there was going to be a serious problem known as the digital divide. And starting almost 16 years ago, he started providing assets to libraries all around the country to try and help bridge that digital divide. So even Gates recognized that not everybody is going to get all their information from their laptop or from their computer. They are going to have to use these institutions that we've had in this country for almost 300 years.
That's really interesting. And maybe there's a little bit more to talk about there, but I want to bring you in too, Jeffrey, from your perspective, again, as somebody who works with libraries on updating their facilities to make it modern and relevant. How would you answer that question of why bother with the library?
Right. Well, we are actually also, as Amy said, quite busy preparing facilities for the future. So there is a lot of activity going on in library facility improvements, library expansions, library transformations to make them be the kind of place that people want to come to. So we're interested in the physical library, you know, as architects, of course. We appreciate you can download digital content from the library for free, which is an important service. But the thing that people like about libraries is that they are the trusted curators of cultural content and historical heritage, and they have librarians is the fundamental thing, that vet the information. So you can trust the information that you can go to the library and source. And why go to the building when you could maybe, you know, call it in or something? Because people need a place to host a conversation. And the library is a place that can support a community conversation of content and meaning.
Now, you mentioned trusted source of information. Some libraries, from what I understand, have gotten on this bandwagon of sort of helping patrons figure out what's fake news and what isn't.
Certainly, yeah.
Amy?
Well, I was just going to talk about people coming to our libraries. And as an example, we've had two libraries since 1909 in Lebanon, the Lebanon Library and the West Lebanon, which was our West Lebanon branch. The West Lebanon branch had three parking spots. It wasn't particularly busy. We built this brand new library that Jeff designed in 2010. We put in 17 parking spots, and people complained about it constantly. We don't have enough parking. Yet it's bringing more and more people in. It's not there's just not enough room for everyone. We had 140,000 people visit the Lebanon libraries last year.
And you're not that big of a town.
No, we're about 13,000, 14,000 people.
Wow.
Yeah.
Jeffrey, go ahead, since you want to jump in.
Why do people want to go? Why are they showing up? Well, part of it is a transformation in what the library facility has become and kind of activities that it supports. Historically, it's been libraries where the place where the books were. And for the last, 100 years or so, the book collections were growing and library facilities were growing quite as fast, and the books are pushing the people out of the library. Not enough place to sit, but the contemporary library has really become a place where people can go and find a place to either sit quietly or read or have a conversation with another person. I keep coming back to the notion of learning by exchanging information, not just sort of downloading information in the sense from the content in the library, having a real conversation.
Go ahead, Michael.
I've been around long enough to remember when we used to have to remove seating in order to put up stacks so that we could accommodate the growing collections. That's one of the big advantages we obviously have now with the digital materials, in that we can now recapture that space for humans to interact, as Jeffrey is indicating, or just to come and sit and contemplate whatever it is that they want to. We used to have to, because there was an explosion of information after the Second World War, lots was being produced, libraries, especially academic libraries, had to accommodate that. And the only way to do it was to take out, either expand the building, but you can't expand the building continuously. You have to take a breather every once in a while, and that's when we would remove seating. So we're heading in the right direction. We're making libraries anchor institutions within our communities. They're very important institutions. Ask almost anybody in the town, where's the library, and they'll be able to tell you. And very often they'll be able to tell you a lot about the library.
You know, that point that you raised, Michael, about, you know, now today with the emphasis on community hubs and conversations that Jeffrey and Amy mentioned, we are able to move books kind of, I hate to put it this way, but out of the way, you know, put them online so that you have more room for those seats, for those spaces. A survey by the Pew Research Center, though, on how Americans feel about their libraries last fall finds people a little conflicted about this. They were asked about how do you feel about moving some print books and stacks out of public locations to free up more space for things such as tech centers, reading rooms, meeting rooms, cultural events. And people felt a little conflicted about this.
Well, sure. We hear the same thing about people not wanting to use Kindles or Nooks or their phones to read because they love the feel of the book, and there's something spiritual when you actually communicate with the book. Well, I think we'll always have that, but candidly, the publishers are going to determine the format that these things take. It's everything is born digital. So they can make a digital copy or they can print a copy. It's a lot more expensive to print it than it is to provide it digitally. So I think that we'll still have that love affair with the book because it's been with us in the current form since Gutenberg first invented movable type in 1453. So we'll always have that affair with books. But people are going to be getting more and more of their information. We find that with the younger generations. You know, they're finding with all kinds of surveys that they have traditionally done by using landlines, for example, that they're missing a whole segment of the population that's very important. And I think the same is true here. But libraries aren't going away. We have new libraries in many communities in New Hampshire, and there are a lot of communities that are planning right now for new libraries.
Wow.
And if people have not seen the Kilton Library in West Lebanon, they should make a field trip because it's a fabulous library.
Well, and we'll definitely talk a little bit later about pulling in younger generations. There's been some research on that. So I definitely want to ask all of you. But let's go to our listeners, lots of people who want to talk about libraries. The exchange number for you to join us with your comments, questions, thoughts about libraries looking into the future, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Adam joins us from Grafton. Hi, Adam. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Yeah, my name's Adam. I'm from Grafton. I'm the chairman of the Board of Library Trustees here in Grafton. Those of you familiar with the what goes on in the Upper Valley, who read the Upper Valley News and whatnot, may have seen the stories about our budget issues in this past year. And I think that actually ties pretty well into today's topic because I really think that the problem in the digital age seems to be more of an identity crisis. I think that people still see libraries as places for books, at least people who don't get to the library that often. And it kind of becomes this double-edged sword where, you know, on the one hand, you got people saying, well, you know, nobody's reading paper books anymore, which just isn't true, as anybody who spends time in the library knows. There's plenty of people that still want the paper books. So a lot of people feel like we're outdated. But then on the other edge of the sword, what you have is, when we make the efforts to try and come into the digital age, when we go out and we get the things, whether it's e-book readers or whether it's audiobook programs and Wi-Fi and things like that or movies, we start to get it from the other side because we're not what people expect the library to be. So, for example, we get a lot of accusations that we're a glorified video store simply because we have DVDs in our collection and a lot more people tend to take out the DVDs because, hey, a free DVD, you know. But to me, a DVD is just a book that a bunch of people brought to life. So I just feel like, you know, we're kind of in this crux moment where, you know, our biggest issue needs to be to change the way people think about the library, that we're not just a place for books anymore, that we're a community center that's trying to help people come into the digital age. And like some of your guests were talking about, you know, we have a lot of people in our town that don't have computers, that don't have internet, and it's just, you know, we're the place that they come to just to learn how to use a computer a lot of the time.
Well,
you know,
and Adam, very articulately put, and you're sort of describing the push-pull of, you know, what is the library? What's its purpose? Should it have, you know, all this technology, or should it stick to its, you know, traditional mission? How well have you been able to reach some sort of a compromise in your town, in Grafton?
Well, I think, again, that's dovetails sort of into our budget issues. I don't think we're doing as well with that as we'd like to. The town does very much appreciate us. I mean, when we go to you know, different meetings in town, everybody talks about how great the library is. But I think, you know, when it comes to trying to get the dollars it takes to make the next advancements that we want to make, again, that's where we run into this identity crisis, that half the people are saying, well, nobody's getting books anymore, and the other half are saying, well, yeah, now that you have movies, you're just a glorified video store.
Wow. All right. Well, Adam, thank you for calling. And Amy, I'd love to hear from you on sort of your thoughts on how they are sometimes struggling to explain an evolved mission to some folks.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that our mission has changed. Our mission has always been to provide information to people and resources to people. So while the format has changed, we're still giving them that information. And if it's no longer in a printed book form, then we will offer it in an electronic form. You know, I think about our reference, you know, and we still do reference. I mean, I do reference on the phone. People will call me up and ask me what the weather will be tomorrow, believe it or not.
Really?
But that's somebody who does not have that capability in their home for whatever reason to find that, you know, or someone brought a bug to me and said, "What? I found this in my garden. What is this bug?" So we're still doing the traditional services. But if you remember, we used to have in the 80s and 90s, and some of us still do, have quite the large reference room with all of these books. And they were very expensive books. And as information became available in other manners, those books were not necessarily getting used the way that they once did. They also would take a long time to update, right? So if you buy a resource and they're going to update it 5 years from now, say it's biographies of famous musicians, and one of those musicians dies on the day that it's published, you're going to have to wait 5 years to hand that information to the next person.
It's not very useful.
It's not very useful. Now, electronically, the day that musician dies, they can update your database, and there it is electronically. So I don't think our mission has changed. I mean, what's changed is the way that we provide that information to
the stuff
people
by which you deliver that mission.
Right.
Is it electronic? Is it a video game? Is it a DVD? Is it?
However it is. And it also depends on your community wants and needs. So if your community would like DVDs, I mean, that's a lot of bang for your tax dollar buck, right? You don't have to buy that DVD. There's this resource that has purchased it for you. And so, you know, there's nothing wrong with knowing what your community needs are and having that available to them.
Go ahead, Jeffrey.
I was just going to interject that to make the library be the kind of destination place in a community where people will want to come, it means a transition from a collection-centric or book-centric place to a place that is people-centric, that provides, you know, quality of space. And I don't mean, you know, that things are gilded there, but I mean there's a quality of finish that's durable, but there's a quality of space that's enticing to people, space that hosts a conversation, supports collaboration, space that you can use to have a moment of focused concentration, have some quiet in the library. These are still important things to provide. The fundamental thing is that the library of the future is a place to find, use, and share information, and supports all of that.
All right. We will talk a lot more after a break. Adam, thank you for that call. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org.
I want to know why it is that people suggest telling your congressional representatives how you feel about the issues. Does it make a difference?
Who can answer the burning questions about government operations?
How does the Electoral College work?
Is this system outdated in our current democracy system?
What is a filibuster, and what purpose does it serve in the government?
Who can help us cleave these Gordian knots?
Civics 101.
Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about the future of libraries. What good is the library when so many people research and read almost exclusively online? We're looking at some of the challenges that New Hampshire's libraries face as they update themselves and stay relevant for the 21st century. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests with us. Michael York is here, New Hampshire's state librarian. He oversees the state library in Concord and also assists New Hampshire's 234 local public libraries. Deputy director of the Lebanon Public Libraries. Yes, there are two in Lebanon. They're lucky. Amy Lappin is here. She's also New Hampshire's representative to the American Library Association, along with Jeffrey Hoover, Library Design Director with Tappe Architects. One more time, that number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. All of you, we talked earlier about younger people and how they feel about the library, how they approach the library. I'm really happy to tell you that I just got an email from Mr. Pryor's fifth grade class at the Fuller School in Keene. And the kids emailed, five or six kids emailed their thoughts. So I'm going to share a couple of them with you, and then I definitely want to hear what you think. Adam says, reading a real book can get you off screens, but you can just buy them on Amazon. Okay, so you talked about that earlier, Michael. Sophie says, we really need libraries because it's a nice, quiet place to read or work. And we need to remember, not everybody has a nice quiet place at home to read or work. You talked about that, Jeffrey. Cassidy says, I think technology will change libraries because people will just go onto their phones and log on to a library app. We should talk about that in a minute. Drew says, libraries may change because you can order books online and they get mailed to you. You read the book and mail it back, kind of like a Netflix subscription. Bronson says, I think that libraries should still be open, but don't add any new books, since new books you can read on electronics. And Chase says, libraries help us learn and open us up to new ideas, facts, fiction, and fantasy. Thank you so much to the fifth grade class, Mr. Pryor's fifth grade class at Fuller School in Keene, for some of those thoughts. And there's some things that we should jump on here. First of all, Bronson's comment. Michael, I ask you, don't add any new books, since new books you can read on electronics. He's taking a deep breath here.
Well, I think not surprising that comment would come from a fifth grader. They see the world differently than we do because of my long history of working in libraries. And I think that we need to be, we need to listen to Bronson. We need to figure out what the resources should be in the library.
It kind of gets to Adam, our earlier caller, though. It sounds like in some communities, there's a real vigorous debate over what should and shouldn't be there, what they should and shouldn't do, and then that comes down to funding.
Well, I think that's part of living in a free society. You're going to get lots of different opinions, and they'll all be valid, certainly to the person who's making them. They'll be valid to a segment of the population. And that's the challenge for libraries. How do we set a course that's going to get to as much of the population as we can? We realize that all people are not going to use the library. And you can drive yourself crazy by trying to get everybody in the town to use the library. That's not going to happen. Some people are just not interested. Some people think that it's not a good use of taxpayer money. But we have to chart a course because there are enough people who think that the library is important. One of the important things I think that's happening in libraries now is there is a greater emphasis, I believe, on programming. I saw just recently that retailers are having a hard time in their bricks and mortar stores because more people are buying things online, but also people are spending more money on experiences. They want to travel. They want to see things. It's a big world out there, and you can be in Europe in 6 or 8 hours, so why not take advantage of that? So We, I think, need to understand that there's more that the library can offer, and I think lots of libraries are doing that.
Experiences. More than books and DVDs, experiences. And
last week, I stopped in at the Bedford Public Library because Rebecca Rule was there doing one of her programs, and somebody that I know from the library told me it was the largest group that they had in a very long time at the Bedford Public Library. So there's an opportunity for us to provide more. We should not become book museums. That's not our role. And we need to be careful about becoming book museums. We need to protect those valuable materials that we have that are old. Obviously, charters from the towns. All of those things need to be protected. But we can't become book museums. We have to be a vibrant organization within the community.
Well, again, thanks again to those fifth graders. Jeffrey, did you want to jump in?
Right. Part of being that vibrant place for the community has to deal a lot with supporting the needs of school-age children, fifth graders, but also older kids in the library. And so many of the facilities we're doing now are really become homework centers after school hours. Where is a group of kids going to get together to work on an assignment? Well, the library is a good source for that, especially if now we're providing little group study rooms, even in the children's area, so that there can be either tutoring going on without bothering other people, or a little homework group getting together, again, without bothering other users of the library. You can have, five sequential homework groups chatting it up in the library at the same time. That's a pretty positive, vibrant, active thing to support in the community. And where is it going to happen if it doesn't happen at the library?
So that requires space, though, right? You have to have little breakout places for those kids to go so that they don't bother other people.
Exactly.
Yeah. Go ahead, Amy.
Well, and the kids' comments were great. A lot of them, though, come down to money, right? So they, why have books at the library if I can buy them on Amazon? So, of course, not everybody can buy books on Amazon, nor does everybody want to buy all of the books that they read. Right.
If I'm only going to read it once, maybe I don't need to own it.
That's right. Or we have families that will come in. You know, we still do the very traditional story times, and they're packed every week. And we have families who have 92 books out at a time. You know, I was one of those moms. You know, are you going to go buy all of those books? No, but you're providing your family with an experience and getting a variety of information and a variety of stories into your home that you wouldn't buy.
All right. So. Well, as I said, New Hampshire seems to love its libraries because we've got tons of people who want to join us. So let's go back to our listeners. And Carolyn's joining us from Somersworth. Hi, Carolyn. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling. I also want to thank you for taking those comments from the kids. I thought those were really insightful and great. I'm a huge promoter of libraries. When I lived in Ohio, I had 5 different library cards and would go almost every day after work. But I've been really disappointed with the library system in New Hampshire. My local library is atrocious. The collection is not impressive at all. And up until a year or so ago, they didn't even have a computerized catalog that patrons could use. They only had a card catalog, which I hadn't used in 20 years, and you could only look up books alphabetical by author, not by subject or by title. I mean, it's really bad, and I think it's great to talk about the future of libraries and the philosophy of libraries, but our libraries are so far behind the times right now. And I think there's not only an economic divide within communities in New Hampshire, there's an economic divide between libraries. And they're not funded equally. They're not funded widely through state taxes. I believe they're funded through local taxes. And so the communities that need the library the most, cities like Somersworth, don't have those resources.
Wow.
If I want to go to the next nearest decent library, which is in Dover, I have to pay $200 a year
to have that library access. Sure.
Yes.
Wow. Well, Carol, I'm so glad you called. And, you know, Michael, I appreciate her point. She's saying, never mind the library of the future, her library of the present is not great.
Well, I I know that the Summersworth Library, they did computerize, as a matter of fact, about 3 years ago now, I think. And it's the issue here, frankly, is it's our political structure in the state of New Hampshire. We have 234 communities in New Hampshire, and we have 234 public libraries, all run by their boards of trustees. There isn't any overarching organization that, if you will, tries to disperse funds so that all libraries will be equal. We have a library in Manchester that serves 100,000 people. We have a library in Piermont that serves 325 people. We don't have county libraries. We don't have regional libraries. It's the structure. It's the political structure in New Hampshire. Our schools are very similar.
I was just going to say, it sounds like.
And you'll remember that we fought for years over trying to balance school funding so that every child in New Hampshire would have an equal opportunity to a good education. I think we're making strides, but we're not there yet.
And so towns that are wealthy or towns that just have a very vigorous love of libraries, they have great libraries. Other towns, not so much.
Right. I went to meet with a group of trustees the other day in a very small community of about 800 people. I found it to be a wonderful opportunity to talk to them, but they are resource challenged. They have a wonderful librarian who does a tremendous amount of work for the citizens in that community. But when she goes to Hachette and asks them to send her a book, they're not going to send it to her unless she sends them some money. And that's our problem in New Hampshire. Our libraries are under, many of our libraries, 75% of our libraries serve fewer than 7,500 people. So there's an automatic challenge in New Hampshire to try and level the plate. That's where the state library comes in, quite frankly. We see it as our role to try and give every citizen in the state a level of library services that is at least adequate. But we're challenged to do that. We have state funds and we have federal funds, and they're not adequate to make every library, all 234, equal. We simply don't have the resources to do that.
Okay,
I agree with the caller. I think that there are very serious challenges, and it comes at the community level. They have to support their library, quite frankly.
So you anticipate my next question, Michael, and maybe I'll get the other two guests in on it as well. So would people like Carolyn be better served to have some of these smaller, less well-funded libraries close and merge with bigger regional libraries? It's the same debate that you have in, you know, towns in terms of schools. You know, we don't have quite enough kids to justify building our own high school. Should we send them away? Should we invest in our own school? It's very similar.
It is very similar, and I don't think that we've come to any real conclusions with that. Some of our communities have developed regional school systems, consolidated school systems,
right,
but others tuition their children to a larger school system. So I think it's our independent spirit in New Hampshire, quite frankly. People move here because I mean, it's not an accident that John Stark said, live free or die. We have a different view of what a community should be providing to people. And it is a challenge, especially a challenge, I think, for organizations like libraries that want to serve everybody at a very high level. Our libraries, our librarians, are incredibly dedicated. But we still have to purchase material. We still have to pay salaries, and it's a real challenge.
Well,
I'll get back. If you let me later on, I'll talk to you about a program that we're working on with a couple of libraries.
Okay. I did want to ask Jeffrey, though. I mean, you've worked with a lot of communities. How do you see them kind of noodling on this problem, Jeffrey? You know, it's wonderful to have my teeny little local public library. On the other hand, it just doesn't have the resources that, as Carolyn says, you know, the library in Dover has. So what do you think?
Well, you know, as architects, of course, we're lucky to work with the communities who find the means to do something about the problem. So we're sort of on the other end of it. And it is a positive thing for communities that when they realize their library improvement, it transforms the community. It makes real estate values go up, makes people more active in the community. They have a venue in which they can run into their neighbors, and it builds a community. It's not just that the community puts up a building, but the building actually helps support the community. So, again, I don't, you know, I'm all for it, of course, from a professional perspective. And then our challenge then is to make it be the kind of library that is going to be uniquely attractive to the people in that particular community, because there isn't any one size fits all solution here. It has to be, you know, custom tailored to the, you know, to these particular needs of community, and give it infuse it with the appropriate sort of community character and identity, and be a reflection of the aspirations of those people, not something that that can be standardized and pushed out.
Sure, go ahead, Amy.
Well, I hate to talk about having any libraries closing, because when you have those small libraries, the people who live near those libraries, I mean, are geographically dependent on those libraries. And so to close them really denies some people access to information and materials. But what I would like to see happen is to find a way to share our resources. We do share some. We certainly have interlibrary loan. The interlibrary loan system, that's fantastic.
I have taken advantage of that many times.
You know, we have the databases, but boy, would it be nice. We charge at $75 now if you would like to get an out-of-town membership to the Levinan Public Library. And you can do anything you would like to while you're in our buildings. You can use our resources. But when you go, you can't take anything. You can't leave with our materials unless you have a library card. And it's frustrating to say that to people. We don't like to say that to people. But our Lebanon taxpayers say, well, wait a minute, we're paying you about $75 a year out of our tax money, so why are they going to get it for free? So if we could change that system somehow and figure out a way to, at least within communities, be able to have that caller be able to go into Dover without paying $200. I understand why they're doing it with this current structure. But if we can think about maybe some creative ways to make that work better.
Yeah, that is a lot. And I understand in Concord, it's $100 to get a library card if you don't live in the city. So, you know, if you're a low-income family with a couple kids, you know, and you don't have a good library in your own little town, maybe you work in Concord, you want to access a library, but that's going to be tough for you. I can see you guys want to jump in, but I want to take another call. This is in Exeter. Jessica's calling. Hi, Jessica. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. Can you hear me okay?
I sure can. Go ahead, Jessica.
Okay, perfect. So this kind of has to deal with what the governor was talking about yesterday in terms of mental health. I went to high school in Dover, Delaware, and due to funding cuts in the arts in my high school, there wasn't a whole lot of creative outlets. So the local library took that stance up, and they had a creative writing group in the evenings. And it really provided a safe spot for us to feel comfortable expressing our own writings, or even just talking about things that were happening in terms of bullying or cyberbullying or things like that. I just didn't know what the New Hampshire libraries had as a push to get more into the communities and more into high schools and allow them to have that safe space.
Wow, Jessica, what a great call. And Amy, it kind of relates to this theme that we've talked about earlier, libraries as a gathering place, and in Jessica's case, a very important gathering place, one that meant a lot to her.
Absolutely. And I know that I am happy to hear from community members who would like to start some sort of a group or a, you know, first of all, we have meeting rooms available to anyone who would like to use them within reason. Most, you know, they're, for the most part, anybody who would like to use a meeting room can use a meeting room. But we also have librarians who want to know what you want. And I talked about knowing your community needs. So certainly if a teenager were to come to me today and say, gosh, I'd really like to have this writing club. Well, we can talk about it. It's fairly easy to set something like that up. So sometimes you just have to ask.
Right. Because if you don't ask, the answer is definitely no. All right. Jessica, thank you so much for the call. We'll take more of your calls and emails in just a moment. So keep it right here. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Ideas come naturally to writers.
I wish.
But how are they with deadlines?
I would say probably 5 times in the history of my column have I gotten it done during the day on Monday. And it's the most incredible feeling. Like, if you could distill that feeling and grind it into a powder, I would snort it.
Apparently, they're just like the rest of us. Whether you're looking for inspiration or commiseration, subscribe to the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop on iTunes or Google Play.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, libraries look to the future. My guests say don't call libraries outdated or old-fashioned. Many of these local institutions have evolved into digital and community hubs while keeping their identity as quiet centers of learning. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. A couple emails that have come in, all of you, that I want to share. Jane in Durham says, I find less emphasis on physical books at my library, and many of the new ones are donated. Jane asks, is this a permanent trend? I miss being able to browse and discover in a continually updated collection. I feel there just aren't that many books in my library. Ebooks, she says, are not a substitute. So, Michael, that's Jane in Durham. Earlier, though, we read an email from a fifth grader in Keene who says, don't add any new books since new books you can read on electronics. So this is the struggle, isn't it? It's kind of the existential struggle of libraries, is trying to please everybody. And exactly. Sometimes there's no way you can do that.
And I would guess that there's quite a gulf in terms of age between our fifth grader and the person from Durham who still wants to use books that are printed rather than electronic. We are challenged because whether you're buying a printed book or I think there's this idea that somehow e-books are free. They're not free in any way. What drives this is the copyright laws. We could produce lots and lots of materials for people, but you have to pay for those things because somebody has taken the time to write this material. There's an organization that has published it. They have to get a return on all of that investment, and so there's a cost associated with it. We are finding that certainly for the individual, the e-books are much less expensive than the printed book. But
Jane misses being able to browse the stacks. And frankly, for myself, I'm on a computer all day. For my own pleasure, I am not going to look at another screen, you know, so I prefer a printed book myself.
But remember, the library that she's using needs to purchase books. They need to purchase databases, electronic databases. They need to purchase videos, because she's not the only person using the library.
Right. So that's the theme we keep getting to.
Right. That I mean, there are different wants and needs and desires by probably the entire community. So.
Well, Jane, I appreciate the email. And by the way, John emailed us. He says, please talk about interlibrary loans. For example, your caller from Summersworth can get books from Dover sent to Summersworth for her use. So go ahead, Jeffrey. I know you want to touch on that.
I think the facility of interlibrary loan has also transformed libraries for the 21st century. I mean, several decades ago, it wasn't so prevalent. And when this happened, this phenomena happened that allows libraries to share their collections, that means that each library doesn't have to have such an extensive collection, while all their readers still get access to the whole spectrum of titles. And so it has helped with the library transformation to more of a people-centered space, because they don't have to have such robust collections at every single location.
Kind of gets back to what Michael said earlier in the show, that libraries have taken away some of the books, as Jane is concerned about, to make spaces for people. But you're saying if you go a little bit of an extra step, you can still get that book that you want.
Well, I think one of the problems I think that we have with the digital world is, if people have to make a request to get a traditional book, it's going to take time to get there, because we're transporting that book over the road the same way we did 80 years ago at about an average of about 45 miles an hour. Because they can get an e-book instantly, they think all of their transactions should be that way.
Yeah.
And I think that's that clearly it's unrealistic. And I think, my God, we have 5 vans on the road 5 days a week, making 18 to 20 stops a day, each one of them. We're reaching 165 of our libraries at least once a week.
Although you could look at it another way. I mean, having used that interlibrary loan myself, it's kind of like Christmas when it finally does come in. So, you know, you could look at it that way. But I know not everybody sees it that way. Go ahead, Amy.
Well, I also, getting back to Jane from Dover, I hope that she's asking, or was it Durham? I'm sorry, from Durham. I hope she's asking the librarians for what she wants. I also know with new books, people will come in. We will buy multiple copies of most new books. People will come in and say, oh, well, you don't have that. Well, it's not that we don't have it. It's just in someone else's home. Put yourself on the shelf. I know with Anthony Doerr's All the Light We Cannot See, when that came out, I don't think that was on our shelf, like physically on our shelf, for 6 months to a year because it was constantly on hold. So make sure you're asking for what you want and asking to have a hold placed for it. It may be a perception that it's not there.
Go ahead, Jeffrey.
Yeah, a lot of that is predicated on the borrower knowing what it is they want to borrow. And this doesn't always happen to be true. This is the benefit of browsing, and sometimes called the myth of browsing, but I don't believe there's actually a myth. There is a value in being able to browse the collection, and digital technologies can actually assist patrons of libraries to browse collections that are digital because the interface is different. If you can browse by looking at the covers of books, almost like on Amazon, and on a touchscreen display, move the books around and open the book and peek inside and say, this one's for me, but oh, look at the one next to it. That's also interesting. That kind of technological assistant with digital browsing is where it's trending. And I think that'll make a tremendous difference in all of these as we transition into an enhanced version of sort of the digital information age.
Well, Jane, thank you again for the email. And John, to you too. Back to our callers. Allison joins us from Grantham. Hi, Allison. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Well, thank you. And my mind is whirling with all these things I want to say. I'm calling specifically, though, to tell you about an experience that I had in a small town in northwest Connecticut, New Hartford. Population, I believe, it's under 10,000. No, it's more like 6,000. Sorry. And many years ago, due to health hazards in the old building that we used in town for our library, only two rooms large or small, I guess, we had to close that building and build a new one. And the price tag was $4 million. And we're talking about a town with no resources. But darn it, we did it.
How did you do it, Allison?
Well, it was all hands on deck. It really was something that a small group of library lovers took on as their challenge. And then from there, it grew. And we did everything from small little dinners at our homes where we talked about the library and its needs. And it took a long time. We did get a grant from the state that helped us in our efforts. But the point that I really want to make is not so much that we managed to build this building, that we're, you know, when I go back to visit friends, it's clear that the
yeah, and Allison, your phone's not great quality, so if you could wrap up, that would be terrific.
The building is outgrowing its space already.
Wow.
But my point is that those of us who've been involved in trying to get this library building off the ground realized that it was not going to move forward with its limited resources unless we established a group that was going to support it, not only with fundraising, but with friend raising.
Right. And so, I've heard of these groups in other communities. And I'm guessing you have one, Amy, in Lebanon, like Friends of the Lebanon Public Libraries. I know Concord has that.
We have a foundation that was instrumental in getting the Kilton Library built. But there's certainly a friends group. I'm the president of the Friends of the Meriden Libraries in the next town over.
And could you just briefly make a lot of library lovers, as Allison puts it, jealous? Why do you have two libraries in Lebanon? You're not that big a town.
Because Lebanon loves its libraries. We are so lucky. You know, we have one library that was built in 1909 to be, it was a Carnegie Library, and designed to be a library in 1999. Then we have this beautiful building that was designed to be a library in 2010. And they're very different spaces. We very much consider ourselves one library in two buildings. They're about 4 miles apart, and they are both humming all day long. It's just a lot of support from our community.
Well, Allison, thank you for telling us about the support from your community. Speaking of that, got a couple emails on that point of community support or lack thereof and how libraries work through this. David in Amherst says, it appears that funding for the Institute of Library Management Services, IMLS, may be at risk. David says, how does it help New Hampshire? What will happen if it is canceled? And what can library patrons do about it? Now, this is part of President Trump's budget proposal. And I want to say capital P proposal, Michael, because lots of things happen on that road. So people shouldn't get too excited about any one particular part of it.
Right. We have been discussing this extensively since President Trump issued what's been called the skinny budget, which is just proposals on agencies that at least he and his advisors think may not be necessary. The Institute of Museum and Library Services, which is the federal agency that sends money to New Hampshire through the New Hampshire State Library, has been on that hit list. There's been a tremendous amount of support that's come from library trustees, library supporters, library lovers about the need for the Institute of Museum and Library Services. In New Hampshire, the funds that we get are a grant from the Institute of Museum and Library Services. They're based on all states getting a floor of $680,000, and then the rest is based on population. So we get $680,000, and then we get another $600,000 because we are 43rd in terms of population in the United States.
So here's my question. We've talked about the importance of libraries to local communities and how, you know, local communities in Allison's case, you know, really need to pull together, step up. Allison told us a great story about how citizens in that town came together. What is the federal interest in that? I mean, you could make the argument that, you know, libraries should be supported by their communities and maybe by their states, but taxpayers in Montana or Louisiana really shouldn't help support New Hampshire libraries.
I think the argument that could be made there is it really important for the federal government to make sure that we have good sidewalks in some of our communities? Well, I think that that's a good thing. Sidewalks are important for children not to get hit by cars, for example. So the federal government helps states and local governments all the time. The total amount of money that's been appropriated for the Institute of Museum and Library Services, it serves the 123,000 libraries that we have in the United States and the 16,000 or so museums that we have in the United States. The total appropriation is $250 million. The budget's $1.5 trillion. It's not very much money. And as I say, we get about $1.2 million. We use it for the interlibrary loan service, for the databases, for our consultants who are critical to the 234 libraries in the state. We get an awful lot of mileage out of the $1.2 million that we receive from the federal government. And other states are echoing this as well. It's a critical piece. Half of our money comes from the federal government.
Wow. Okay, that's a lot here in New Hampshire. So speaking again of money, here's an email from Nancy who says, here in Enfield, we are struggling to build a new library, and funding it is the issue. Now, maybe Nancy should talk to Allison and Grantham, who made it happen. Nancy says, there's a lot of support for funding content, but nothing for bricks and mortar. Any suggestions, Nancy says. And Jeffrey, you've worked not just in New Hampshire, but in other states. So I just wonder what examples you've seen from your work broadly as to how people make this happen.
Well, yes, there are a lot of bond initiatives that get floated by communities in order to support their libraries. But usually before it gets to that point, there is the support for the library is based on an independent fundraising effort, which means there are local individuals willing to commit to a certain fundraising goal to get the project off the ground, and then ask the rest of the community to collectively chime in and support the thing going forward. But it really depends on a local groundswell of interest in supporting the library. And it also depends, the success of the outcome of that depends on the participation of those community members in the process of contributing their ideals for the Library of the Future, to make sure the facility that emerges actually supports their particular community needs.
Right. And again, that gets into your work as an architect, making sure that it isn't just four walls, but that it works for what people need.
Right. I think that's and the challenge of generating support for libraries, the fundamental thing is not to sell bricks and mortar, not to sell architecture, but in fact to sell service. That is the thing that happens within the box that we as architects put up for you. It is the quality of service that library provides that is their essential value.
Well,
it isn't the bricks and mortar.
And I apologize for throwing this to you, Amy, at the last minute, but someone just sent in an email. Your guest, Amy Lappin, brings deep knowledge and expertise to this discussion. You might have already discussed this, but our libraries have shown great leadership in protecting First Amendment rights, from the books offered to privacy protocols on the public access computers. This is yet another reason for us to support libraries as an institution. This is an email from a friend of yours. And this is great because I did need to ask you about this. You guys were kind of in the national spotlight not too long ago for, using Tor and so forth, which is when we're a private server.
Well, that's right. I mean, we run a Tor exit node. So what we're talking about is providing people with the ability to have privacy online, right? And so one thing we do is run this Tor exit node, which means anybody anywhere in the world who uses the Tor browser, wherever they are. So if you're in China and you are using their Tor browser, that gets your email, gets pinged around the globe, and it may come out, or the recipient, it may look to the recipient like it came out of the Kilton Library in West Lebanon, right? But it is an important thing that we do because there is this real digital divide. And when you're talking about things like the Tor browser or having a VPN, which is a virtual private network, those are things that cost money. And it prevents people from tracking your online activities. But if that costs money and it's not available to people, the general public, you're talking about only people with money at some point will have their privacy protected. So that's a role that libraries can play in offering ways for people to protect their privacy online and in person.
Well, fodder for a future discussion. And we'll wrap it up there for today. I want to thank everybody very much for being here. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.